Hello and welcome back to the Fall of the Roman Empire. My name is Nick Holmes and this is episode 29 called Rebellion in the West. In the last episode, we heard about the rise of Persia under Shapur II and the threat this posed to Rome in the East. We also heard about the conflict between Constantine's sons in the West, with Constans emerging the victor. Then we heard about Constans's unexpected death, killed by a rebellious general called Magnentius, who proclaimed himself emperor in the West. Now the empire was facing civil war again, the very worst state of affairs for an empire that had been crippled in the past so many times by internal conflict. So, let's go back to Magnentius's seizure of power in AD 350. As you heard in the last episode, the story goes that Magnentius was attending a military dinner in Gaul when he stepped outside to don a purple toga, and when he returned, the senior army officers greeted him with cries of Augustus. Presumably, this is in fact shorthand for what must have been a long-prepared military coup. The surprising thing is that it caught Constans completely by surprise. He was on a hunting expedition at the time and realised only too late that he was now the prey. Magnentius's soldiers hunted him down and killed him, and the Roman armies in Britain and Spain joined those in Gaul in proclaiming Magnentius as Augustus. So, what would happen now? Magnentius was extremely popular with the Western army, so there was no likelihood that he too would be assassinated anytime soon. Life had suddenly become a lot more complicated for Constantius II, who, sitting in Constantinople, suddenly had not one, but two major problems: Persia in the east, and now Magnentius in the west. So what would Constantius do? Initially, it seems that Magnentius wanted recognition by Constantius rather than war. Hoping to establish some sort of legitimacy in Constantius's eyes, he married a great-granddaughter of Constantine I's, called Justina, and minted coins bearing Constantius's image alongside himself. This worked for 6 months, certainly while Constantius was still engaged fighting the Persians. But, as mentioned in the last episode, there was, however, a bit of unexpected good news for Constantius, for Shapur suddenly had to call a truce in the east because of an invasion of steppe nomads called the Massagetae in the northeastern rim of the Persian Empire. This actually happened a few months after Magnentius usurped authority in the west, which was in January 350, so it wasn't until June or July that year that Persian forces withdrew from besieging Nisibis, freeing up Constantius to focus fully on the west. By that time, Magnentius's power base had increased. He'd usurped Constans's remaining territories, including North Africa and Italy. In Rome, there was a short-lived coup against him led by a man named Julius Nepotianus, a nephew of Constantine I, and as one of the last surviving blood relatives of the great emperor, he unwisely decided to bid for the purple, only to find that his supporters melted away when confronted by Magnentius's legionaries, who arrested and executed him. So, Magnentius was now in a very powerful position in command of most of the Western Empire. However, there was still one important territory which was, as yet, undecided who to support, and this was Illyria. And you'll remember the Romans called a large part of modern Croatia and Serbia Illyria, and it was a very significant part of the empire because it contained a powerful Roman army whose job was to defend the Danube. And of course, it had been the place where the great soldier emperors like Claudius, Aurelian, and Diocletian had all come from. Now, in the division of the empire between Constantine's three sons, Illyria had gone to Constans, while Constantius controlled Thrace, which was the western half of the Balkans. So this army was the crucial remaining pawn in the power struggle between Magnentius and Constantius. Now, if it had joined Magnentius, as he was urging it to do by sending his envoys begging them to make terms with him, then combining the Illyrian legions with his Rhine legions would probably have been too strong for Constantius's eastern army, especially since it had been depleted through years of war with Persia. However, the Illyrian legions went for a third option, and Constans's former magister peditum, meaning commander of infantry, called Vetranio, was proclaimed emperor, forestalling Magnentius. Ultimately, this proved to be another stroke of good fortune for Constantius, since it enabled him to negotiate with Vetranio and secure his support. But that certainly wasn't how it started, for initially Vetranio started off by wanting to rule as the third emperor of Rome, perhaps not unreasonably thinking there had been three of Constantine's sons, so why not continue the tradition of a triarchy? But he was then persuaded to reconsider this by an unusual woman who took centre stage in Roman history for the next few years, and this was Constantius's sister called Constantia. Now, she's an interesting character because she was made a saint in the Middle Ages, despite the fact that in her lifetime she appears to have been a ruthless and rather bloodthirsty political operator, as you're about to hear. But first of all, who was she exactly? Well, she was the elder of Constantine the Great's two daughters, and he seems to have been particularly fond of her since he ordered the construction of a grand church in Rome to be her mausoleum, which still stands today and is called Santa Costanza. Now, in AD 350, she suddenly became politically important as a wedding partner in the fragmenting Roman political world. This started when the usurper Magnentius first suggested to Constantius that he marry her, but Constantius wasn't having that, and nor, it appears, was Constantia, for she decided to make a play for political power herself. Although she'd been married to Hannibalianus, who you may remember was one of the five co-emperors nominated by Constantine the Great, and was killed, indeed, by her brother Constantius back in 337, rather surprisingly, she now decided to back her brother. As Constantine the Great's favourite daughter, it seems that she still had considerable political influence, and she met Vetranio and was apparently instrumental in not just encouraging him to proclaim himself emperor and prevent the Illyrian army from joining Magnentius, but then also in persuading Vetranio to join forces with Constantius against Magnentius. For under Constantina's guidance, Vetranio and Constantius met at Cerdica in late AD 350, and before the assembled Illyrian legionaries, Vetranio abdicated and proclaimed Constantius the true emperor. The soldiers applauded and swore loyalty to Constantius. Some sources say that the soldiers' switching of allegiance was spontaneous in response to a rousing speech delivered by Constantius. More likely, however, is that Constantius had been busy buying up the support of Vetranio's senior officers, as well as promising him a comfortable retirement. Certainly, Constantius delivered on this final point, and Vetranio was allowed to live in a luxurious villa in Bithynia until his death 6 years later. This was a decisive coup for Constantius, since it meant his army was now numerically larger than Magnentius's. And this was probably the reason why he decided to risk everything on a war with Magnentius. However, whether this was in the best interests of the empire is another question. For in 351, probably well over 50% of the entire Roman army was manoeuvring in two large opposing groups just south of the Danube in Illyria and Pannonia, getting ready to fight each other. After months of marches and counter-marches, on September the 28th, 351, the two armies met at a town called Mursa, close to the Danube, which Magnentius was besieging. Various sources describe the battle, and all of them say that it was a bloody conflict. In the end, Constantius was victorious, helped by the defection of one of Magnentius's senior generals called Silvanus. And according to the account written by the future emperor Julian the Apostate, by the success of the Roman heavy cavalry from the Eastern army. But whatever the reasons for Constantius's winning the day, it was a Pyrrhic victory. The chronicler Zonarus says that Magnentius lost 2/3 of his army and that Constantius lost 40% of his. Zosimus says that it critically weakened the Roman army's ability to counter its enemies. Constantius had won the battle for himself, but the Roman Empire had suffered losses that it could ill afford. Thereafter, Magnentius's support evaporated. Constantius briefly campaigned against the empire's real enemies along the Danube, the Sarmatians, before invading Italy in 352 and then crossing the Alps. Magnentius sued for peace, but Constantius knew he had the upper hand and wanted to finish the usurper off. So Magnentius made a last stand in the Alpine foothills at a place called Mons Seleucus, where he was again defeated. Although we have virtually no details of the battle, it is safe to assume that it was a smaller and less bloody engagement than Mursa. Magnentius fled to Lugdunum in Gaul, where, on the 10th of August, 353, he committed suicide. Constantius had achieved his aim of securing sole control of the empire. However, the military cost had been enormous, and with a resurgent Persia in the east and growing pressures from the Germans along the Rhine and Danube, the Roman army was being stretched to breaking point, just as it had been in the crisis of the 3rd century. As for Constantius, although he might have secured sole control of the empire, this did not make him feel any more secure. The empire's greatest weakness was its propensity for civil war, and it was more true in the late empire than it had ever been that usurpers could spring up wherever they could gain the support of the army. The military anarchy of the 3rd century had proved how debilitating this could be for the empire, and although Diocletian's solution in the form of the Tetrarchy worked well during his own reign, perhaps the empire's greatest weakness was its continuing inability to find a solution to this question. And Constantius was no more able than anyone else to solve this challenge. Not only had he engaged in a destructive civil war to assert his own authority, but when he won it, he resorted to installing his relatives into positions of power in the hope that they would prove loyal to him. And the first example of this was to prove disastrous. For when Constantius was fighting Magnentius, he appointed his cousin, Constantius Gallus, as his Caesar to administer the eastern provinces. You might remember that Gallus was one of the few survivors of the Massacre of the Princes in 337, when Constantius had murdered 9 of his relatives, including the 2 co-emperors Dalmatius and Hannibalianus, to secure power for himself and his brothers. This was probably because he was considered too young to merit being killed. Now, Constantius, looking around in desperation for people who might be loyal to him, hoped that this blood link would be the foundation of a mutually beneficial relationship. This might surprise you when you consider that he'd murdered most of his relatives, but equally, perhaps that explained their murder because he saw them as the greatest threat to him if they weren't on his side. Certainly, it was true that Constantius personally placed a very high value on legitimacy, so it was much more important to him which family you were descended from rather than if you were vaguely suitable for the job. He certainly wasn't alone in this respect, and plenty of people, both in past and future history, would try to keep power within the family, But it must be said that the best of the late Roman emperors tended to be those that could spot talent and promote it and ideally keep it loyal to them. Diocletian was undoubtedly the best example of this, and the mutual respect that existed between him and his tetrarchs was legendary and the secret of the Roman Empire's recovery in the late 3rd century. But Constantius was no Diocletian, and his obsession with keeping senior positions within his family circle would ultimately prove to be his undoing. In Gallus's case, he could not have chosen a less suitable ruler for the eastern provinces. Our best source on this period, Ammianus Marcellinus, is merciless about Gallus's complete lack of moral integrity. For example, once he took control of the Eastern Roman administration, basing himself in Antioch, he started to accept bribes in legal cases referred to him, even executing a nobleman in Alexandria apparently in exchange for a large bribe from the unfortunate man's mother-in-law. This is where Constantius's sister Constantina reappears, for she had married Gallus when he was appointed Caesar in the East, and according to Ammianus, she was even worse than him. Quote, "She was a fury in mortal form, incessantly adding fuel to her husband's rage, and as thirsty for human blood as he." End quote. The two of them carried out a reign of terror, which was made even worse by the warring political factions in Antioch and Alexandria, who were more than happy to exploit Gallus and Constantina's corruption to have their enemies exiled or killed. For example, according to Ammianus, Constantina condemned an innocent nobleman to death in exchange for a valuable necklace which she liked the look of. It is therefore a bit surprising and a touch humorous that in modern Rome, Constantina has her own church, Santa Constanza, where she's revered as a saint. What on earth, you might ask, is going on? Well, it's absolutely true that she was buried in the church that her father Constantine the Great built for her, and which remarkably has survived to this day. And it's also true that in the Middle Ages, a legend developed about this church, which said that she was a wealthy woman who was miraculously cured of leprosy, whereupon she devoted her life to supporting the poor of the city. Quite how such a legend developed, which is so at variance with the historical records, is, as they say, anyone's guess. But let's get back to the 4th century, and in particular to the year 354. Not surprisingly, Constantius, who was in Milan at this time, implementing his new rule over Magnentius's Western Empire, was outraged at the news of what Gallus and Constantina were up to, and he ordered their immediate recall to explain their actions. Constantina left first, but according to Ammianus, she died in Bithynia of a fever, although you do wonder whether there was actually a more sinister cause of death. Gallus then reluctantly followed after her, stopping to enjoy the chariot races at Constantinople, where he sat in the imperial box, much to Constantius's fury. When he reached Pannonia, he was arrested by Constantius's soldiers, and his interrogation began. He told them that he was innocent and had been misled by Constantina. On hearing this, Constantius, who was still in Italy, ordered Gallus's immediate execution. And so ended the life of one of the last of Constantine the Great's relatives. But Constantius still felt that he needed blood relatives to help him govern the empire, especially one in the west now that he wanted to go back to the east and sort out Gallus's misrule. So he chose his last remaining relative, a young cousin who in 355 was 24 years old. He was about as different to Gallus, as you could possibly imagine, a young man who'd spent most of his youth studying Greek philosophy and was troubled by the rise of Christianity. He would in due course become one of the most celebrated Roman emperors, as famous for his philosophy as for his military skills, a man whose tragically short reign seesawed from victory to disaster. He was Julian the Apostate. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, of course, I'd be delighted for any ratings or reviews in whichever podcast app you use. And in the next few episodes, we'll hear the utterly extraordinary story of one of the most fascinating of all Roman emperors, Julian the Apostate. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.